Hello and welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. You can find more podcasts on a variety of topics by visiting www.educause.edu/podcasts. You can also find us on iTunes by searching for EDUCAUSE. This podcast features a keynote address from the 2010 Mid-Atlantic Regional Conference. It's a speech by James Hilton, Vice President and CIO for the University of Virginia, entitled Disruption and Strategic Alignment.
So here's the dilemma that I want to start with. One of the things that I'm struck with when I walk across any of our campuses is how familiar it is. Not only how familiar it is to me, but how familiar it would be to my parents and even to my grandparents. That much of what we do, particularly in teaching, still has a form that would be recognizable back through the centuries. And I find that a curious thing because technology is changing everything so quickly, and yet the university seems relatively stable, particularly in its teaching methods. We have introduced some new bells and whistles. We have fancier labs than we had before, but the basic structure, the bread and butter of much of, particularly the undergraduate curriculum, has not changed in centuries. And I find that curious. Now, when you talk about that and you talk about how universities are in a period of dramatic change, and particularly if you say technology plays a role in that, lots of people will sit back and say, heard it before. Film strips were supposed to change teaching. Movies were supposed to change teaching. TV was supposed to change teaching. Computers in elementary classrooms were supposed to change teaching, all those things, and yet, you know, those technologies come and go, and yet it doesn't feel like a lot of things have changed. And if that's your reaction, I would encourage you to think about the fact that lots of people in the music industry probably thought the same thing, from LPs to vinyl to cassettes to tapes to CDs, right up until they had the combination of CDs and internet. And then everything changed. And it is my belief that universities are, over the next 10 years, going to experience a redefinition, a rebirth, a reforging. I don't know if we're going to experience this at a birth. I hope we are. But a reforging over the next 10 years that's going to rival any of the transformations in the past, that's going to be on the same scale as that thing that gave birth, those changes and forces that gave birth to the public research university, for example, following World War II. Put another way, even though lots of what we do feels familiar, even though a lot of the bread and butter of education feels the same, even as we sleep, it's changing. And the reason why it's changing is because the fabric of inquiry is changing. So I'm going to argue that the change that's going to come to the undergraduate curriculum especially is going to come because the methods of inquiry are changing, not directly because we've introduced some new gee whiz technology. And what do I mean by that? Well, let's take some examples. We now live in a world where technology is enabling new methods of inquiry, new methods of asking fundamental questions and of introducing new questions. So consider just a couple of things. Technology now enables us to work with enormous data sets to ask questions, to look at problems that were too complex to be answered by looking at only 5 or 10 variables. So here's a little factoid. I like factoids. CNN, I think, used to have factoids. Factoids are sort of, they might be true, right? They sound like they ought to be true. This one, I think, actually is true. When CERN, which is the super collider in Switzerland, when it comes online and stays online, it's come online a couple of times, but when it comes online and stays on time, it's a huge particle accelerator instrumented. I think the entire loop is something like 12 miles long. It's got thousands and thousands and thousands of instruments. It will, in its first year of operation, produce 3 million DVDs worth of data. And it actually only operates for 6 months because of the power consumption and the temperature concerns, right? 3 million DVDs of data. In fact, apocryphally at least, physicists claim that in its first full year of operation, it will produce more recorded data than have been recorded in the history of physics. And it's just one of the instruments. The same kind of instruments are coming on among earthquake engineers, among biologists. We can deal with huge, huge reams of data and do complex computations, and it's going to lead us to ask new and different questions. And it's not just in the sciences. Point about this is that as you have these tools, it will change disciplines. So think about literary text criticism. Not a literary text critic. Don't do it at home. Don't play for it. Don't. Not a professional. Don't play it. But what I do know is that Google has 28 million volumes lined up to be digitized and indexed. And if those volumes are accessible, indexed, searchable, text analysis and text criticism has to change. Because in the old days, if you wanted to be, for example, a Shakespeare scholar, you were limited to those texts, those manuscripts that were available in your library and that you had the time to go for. Now, 28 million volumes are there. We have an English professor, a computational English professor. I like that. We have an English professor at Virginia who looks at irony at the level of individual words across millions of texts. Not possible without the technology. Similarly, think about visualization. Technology now, and one of the things that I'm always struck by as a psychologist is if you look at the sheer amount of brain that's devoted to visual processing, it's huge. And yet if you think about our pedagogy and inquiry, for the longest time, for most of humanity, it has been linear, it has been verbal, written, or mathematical. A linear model of exploration. And we now have tools that allow us to actually go in and visualize things. So, for example, this is work by Mark Yeager, again at Virginia, who does work on things like how HIV fits in cell membranes, how does it physically connect and infect, or looks at how potassium channels in individual cells in the heart regulate heartbeat. So again, people say visualization, you go, well, that sort of makes sense in the sciences. I get that. What about in the humanities? Well, I think visualization is going to dramatically change the humanities. This is a still image of a work that Bernie Fisher, also at Virginia, has been doing. They have a model of ancient Rome from 2,000 years ago. It's a true mathematical model of the city. They have approximately 40 buildings that are fully mathematically modeled. And it produces 3D images. Interestingly, the processors that they use are game box processors. It produces a stereoscopic image in which you can not just look at pretty pictures. You can go in and you can ask, what did the view in Rome 2,000 years ago look like from this hill? And actually see it. You know, and I at one part of me always goes, okay, so that's kind of cool, right? Does it really mean anything? And I have to tell you that one of the things about moving to Virginia, I'm the child of academics. I've spent my entire life in college towns, and there are lots of great college towns. One of the things, though, that is striking about Charlottesville and the University of Virginia is that you really do come to sense the relationship between physical place and history and social movement. You know, UVA was Jefferson's vision of a new form of education for North America. And you realize after you've been there that UVA could not have been born out of sight of Monticello. And that Monticello, to this day, still exerts an enormous influence over UVA's ambition, sense of itself, what it does. So the point about that is that it's not just glitzy little videos that are cool to watch. It allows you to start to go back. I mean, if you think about pitting 3D, though, if you haven't seen Avatar yet, think about what happens when Avatar fully consumerizes. And that's the visualization that people are able to work with on commodity devices. What are the questions that you can start to ask, particularly if you tag that with GIS stuff, and you can really start to see how the land, how history shapes social forces and social movement. Again, fundamental questions if you're a humanist, right? And it's going to change it. Or think about the way in which technology now enables collaboration at a global scale. So while it's been true for a long time in the sciences that the image of the lone scholar toiling away in the lab, waking up in the middle of the night going, "Eureka, I've figured out the solution," has given way to teams of globally connected scientists working on incredibly complicated data sets, complicated methods, as a group and producing things. I was when I was at Michigan and was in the provost's office, one of my duties was to review tenure and promotion cases. And one of the rules that you have in the provost's office at Michigan, if you get a tenure and promotion case, is that all the reviews have to be at arm's length, meaning you can't have them from co-authors. And the provost's office is the last stop in the review, right? It's not the time when you want to identify a problem, really, right? And so I'm reading these cases of he was an earthquake scientist, actually. I was reading his tenure case, and I suddenly started getting concerned, because I noted that more than half of his letter writers were also co-authors and mentioned that fact in their letters. And I'm sitting there going, well, how? This is a big no-no, right? How could this make it? So I started digging into his vita more, and what I discovered was he had two papers, one that had 100 co-authors and the other that had 150 co-authors, and there are probably no more than 250 people in this discipline. Right? So it's changing our conceptions of how science happens and how you make attributions of value and responsibility. Right? And it's, again, though, while that's given way in the sciences, it is increasingly happening in the humanities. So this is a website, Nines, again, out of the University of Virginia, and it is really an online interactive community of 19th century literary scholars. These are webbed up and connected in their scholarly pursuit. So like part of the challenge that this is putting into the academy is this doesn't look anything at all like what English professors traditionally get tenured for. And yet if you think about what English professors traditionally get tenured for, what they get tenured for is an extended conversation held in public, traditionally through a series of monographs. Right? And what determines in the end whether you get tenure or not is whether or not you impact the views of your discipline. You know, the bottom line is if you impact your discipline, you're going to get tenure. And if you don't, maybe not. Maybe, but maybe not. But I would assert that if you have an impact on your discipline, universities will find ways to tenure you. But in the established way, we always know that. So you have to have a book, right? The sort of stand, the way that translates to a formula for English professors is got to have a book at least under contract by the time you come up for tenure to even be considered. Well, this is where that public dialogue is happening now. And in fact, books often, only certainly in the sciences it's the case, that publications are just documenting things after the fact. Nobody in physics works off of the publications. They work off of the stuff that hasn't been published yet. By the time it comes out and is published, it's just a record, right? So, again, the technology is changing. My point is that if the fabric of inquiry is changing, it's not that the wolf is at the door. The wolf is in the living room, underneath the sofa, peeking out. It's already amongst us. Dramatic change is happening because as faculty, research, and scholarship changes, their teaching will surely change following it, right? Because otherwise, it's always just more work. And in fact, if you think about it, when we talk about introducing instructional technology for faculty, it often feels like added work for them because it's not the way they do lots of other things. And I think what we're going to see is rapid change pushed by this convergence, pushed by the fact that the same conceptually tools that people use in their course management systems are the same tools that they're using to collaborate with their fellow scholars, right? So rapid change is coming. But what do we think about? What does it mean to talk about change? A couple of observations about the way I view change. I think most people think that what change really should be is, right, we all have this view that the way I want change to happen is I want to get through change so that I can enjoy the still waters, the calm periods of reflection, the time when the real work gets done. Because when I'm in the midst of a change, I can't get anything else done. I'm just changing. And so I think the image that we have is change is a gradual process, little rapids, but mostly life is still waters. And I'm going to tell you change is less this than this. And I want to point out, everybody on there is smiling, except one guy on the right there who's clearly looking at a rock and thinking, oh, something. Right? It's more like this, and then here's the kicker. It's all the way down. It's constant. This notion that what we need to do is to figure out how to manage for bursts of intense change and then hold everything constant is a fiction. It's a fiction in our organizations, and it's a fiction for the faculty. You know, one of the struggles that we have with faculty is technology is always coming in and bringing in new capabilities, new things, and faculty are saying, just leave it alone, right? I just learned the system, leave it alone. So one of the challenges that we have is, how do you manage, both as an IT organization, to find a way to sustain and thrive in a world of constant change, and how do you do that with the collaborators that you have across campus who don't have a model that says it's constant change all the time? And I always point out, you know, people say, well, if it's rapids are really scary. They are. Of course, it's also the case that people pay big money to ride rapids. So there's got to be some joy in there somewhere. And the trick is to figure out how to leverage, how to find and leverage that joy. So the first observation about change is it is dramatic and it is continuous. It's rapid and continuous. The second is, and this one I think is the one that's a little harder to get sometimes, is that change is emergent. And I mean two things by that. One, the kinds of disruptive changes that we're talking about, it's often the case that what started on one end doesn't look anything at all like the other end. It's totally disruptive. And the second is that it's emergent. It's not planned. Doesn't mean that people don't plan. Change is, in fact, emergent. Let me see if I can give you a couple of examples. I think we all tend to think about change as occurring like this. You set out a plan. I'm going to go farm, so I'm going to go plow. I'm going to put nice straight rows in. Or I need to bring water from point A to point B, so I go dig a nice straight canal to do it. We think of change that way. Think about how you do planning processes, right? The way you do a planning process is you say, boy, we are here. We need to be over here. So what do? Lots of times, first thing you do is you hire some consultants, right? And the consultants come in, and the consultants say, well, what we need to do is a gap analysis. You're here, you want to do here, okay? So you throw a lot of energy and resources, you do a gap analysis, right? And they say, if you do this, you will move the organization. So you put forward a business case, you get funding for it, and you do that. Consultants are there for 12 months, 18 months, however long the project is, and in fact, everything moves over there, right? And at the end, the consultants go, and you're where you wanted to be, and everything's fine, except that that's if the world is static and change isn't emergent. What really has happened, of course, is that in the time that you're doing this, the world keeps changing, and where you want to be keeps changing. So you start here, you want to be there, you do the gap analysis and everything. Well, by the time you close it up, you're here, but where you really want to be is over here. Well, actually, over here. Because if you're over here, you'd already have to be justifying more consultants. But now, you're only here, so you wait a little while, and then you need more consultants, and you come in and you do a gap analysis, and you do it, and it seems like an ever-ending cycle. And I think that's because this is the model of change we implicitly buy into. And in fact, this is the world of change. The world of change is emergent. The way I like to think about it is, you know, at Virginia, for example, Jefferson did plan to build a public university. He did not plan to build a public university with 10 schools and football, right? Or theater or a whole bunch of other things. The world emerges, which doesn't mean planning is unimportant, but it means that as you think about change, you have to prepare for the fact that as you change, other things are changing too. It's an emergent world, right? So what does that mean? Emergence is not chaos, but I mean, the good news is emergence is not chaos. A lot of times when I talk about emergent, people go, so that just means we're hopeless. You're just always going to be reacting. No, I don't think so. What emergence says is it's not chaos. In emergence, you do have a known starting point. I can at any given time say, where am I to be today? And although you don't have what you don't have is an endpoint that you know where you want to be, but you usually do know the direction that you want to be, right? I know that I want to have more support for computational science. I know that I want to have more technology support for faculty, right? I know that I want to have more support for mobility, right? I know the direction I want to go in. I just can't tell you, does that mean that I want iPhones or droids or what, right? So you have a known starting point and an unknown endpoint. And what you also can do is identify what I think of as fundamental conditions. What are those trends that are shaping the world that you find yourself in right now? And what you want to start trying to do is to adjust to those fundamental conditions. And we're going to spend some time talking about what I think right now in the technology, in our space, technology and education, some of those fundamental forces are. And then what you want to do is instill a discipline of fine-tune as you go to refine it based on experience. In other words, in a world of emergence, rather than spending a whole lot of time on the front end doing a strategic analysis, gap analysis, resource allocation, and implementation plan, what you spend a lot of time doing is saying, what are our core competencies? What are the things that matter that we need to be doing? And how do we, and which direction do we want to go in? And then every day, when I first became the associate provost at Michigan, after I'd been in it about 6 weeks, the provost said to me, so what's your plan? What are we going to do to make this place better? And how are you going to know? And I said, well, you know, Paul, not to sound too Reagan-esque, really, if tomorrow's better than today, I'm going to be pretty convinced we're going in the right direction, and I'm good with that. And I remember Paul saying to me, you know, this guy's a brilliant guy. He said, you know, I think you're right, but you're going to have to find a better way to package it. Right? This is my way of packaging it. Essentially what I'm saying is we're in emergence. We know directions where we want to go. You can get consensus around directions, and then what you have to do is constantly evaluate, is this still the direction that we want to go in? You know, if to go back to the sort of traditional change management thing, really, another way to think about it is if you think about organizations, right? Organizations just aren't this dot in time. Organizations have momentum. So usually it's really the case that, think about it like a car. A car is moving to the northwest. Where do you want to be? Some point over to the northeast. So you do the gap analysis and you bring all these resources in. And really, you think about it, if you don't change, if you don't adjust the organization to the underlying fundamental conditions, right, what you're really doing is pouring a whole lot of resources in to slide the car sideways, four-wheel drift, right? So you then end up, again, now two things have happened. Over time, where you want to be has changed. We talked about that earlier. But the second thing is when you take the controls off, right, the consultants leave, the organization is still headed northwest. So, again, you get to those consultants again faster because you're moving this way and you still want to be over there. So what is it? So in the world that we're operating in Virginia right now, we really are trying to say, what are the fundamental, what are the three or four directional goals we want to hit? And what are the things that are driving it? And in a constant method of assessing, are we getting closer or not? So if it's change and it's constant, right, and it's emergent, how do you navigate? And the argument that I'm going to make is find the strong currents, these fundamental conditions, and learn to ride them. So what are you with me? This is a deadly room to talk in, I have to tell you. Okay. So what are some of them? I'm going to talk about, I think, four of them today. These are disruptive forces. Again, these forces that render, as we go through the examples, I would argue, they render what comes out of the other side almost unrecognizable from what went in on what the input was. So the first is unbundling. And these are all what I would argue are technology-enabled or technology-driven disruptions. And to be clear, it's not that I think that disruption is something that is good or bad or that we control. Disruption is happening. Technology is doing it. The only questions are, how do we respond to it? Okay? So I would argue, for example, that if there's any single truth about technology, what technology does, and particularly information technology with a vengeance, is it comes in and it takes some established business process, some established way of doing something, and it unbundles it. it just blows it up. And then somebody comes along and rebundles it in new ways. And that's how things move along. So let's just take a couple of examples. Think about banks. When I was a kid, right, and you went to the bank, right, you went to the bank on Saturday. Why? Because banks required face-to-face interaction. They had convenient hours like 9:30 to 3:30, right, and Saturdays from 10 until 2. So everybody went to the bank on Saturdays. You'd go to the bank, you'd stand in a long line, there'd be a whole bunch of tellers there. It was a social event because you'd see everybody that you knew. I grew up in the South, so that meant that after we finished banking, we went out for barbecue. It was just a grand old time, right? Think about how you do banking today. Most of the banking you do online. When you have to do physical banking, right, you probably do it at an ATM. And I now, in fact, do it when I don't know about you, but when I drive up to the ATM and there's a car in front of me, it's... I get up there, and I now use the paperless, you know, deposits, checks, and all that kind of stuff. And if it takes me more than about 45 seconds, I'm pretty ticked, right? By the way, think about that same dynamic as you think about faculty and the technology you introduce and how we keep thinking we're making stuff easier and easier, but we can't make it easy fast enough because part of what's happening is out there, user interfaces and stuff are changing, becoming so much more user-friendly, that their expectations for what it means to be easy are changing. What used to be easy now looks hard, even if it's objectively easier than what we used to do. So anyway, so unbundling of banks. Totally, and now it totally transforms. Right? There are banks which charge you if you actually want to see somebody face-to-face. Right? And I don't know about your bank, but sometimes if you go into banks that haven't been remodeled, it's row after row of tellers with one person there and all this wasted space. Second area, think about publishing. Newspapers right now are going through enormous challenges. And I would argue that the reason why they're going through challenges is because technology has unbundled their business process. They had this process. Send out reporters, cover it, write it up, put it in a newspaper, sell that newspaper. And all the things that contributed to it, the writing, the editing, all that kind of stuff, are bundled in the physical delivery of the product. And now we live in a world of electronics, of electronic access, of RSS feeds, where all of that's unbundled, right? And how it's going to get repacked, right? Google has figured out a way to rebundle it and make money, become a news aggregator and sell advertising, right? It's a new business model, but it completely blows away traditional models of publishing. And if you think about publishing and scholarly publishing, the opportunities for universities to now go in and say, wow, let's see, What does publishing involve? It involves writing. It involves editing and peer review and distribution and archiving. We do all of that. We do every bit of that. Right? We no longer necessarily need publishing houses to come in and aggregate all those resources and deliver back to us a published product. We haven't changed it yet. The open access movement is changing some of the things. But publishing is one of those things, particularly scholarly publishing, that is in huge flux right now. And I would argue that it's not because of philosophy, it's not because of intent, it's not what people want, it's because the technology has done this. It's come in and unbundled it. Think about the music industry. Right? If you listen to the Recording Industry Association, what is the number one problem that they face? Piracy. And I just have to get one little, you probably know the statistic, but in case you don't, I'm going to make sure you do. If you were to ask somebody not in IT, if you were at a cocktail party and ask them, based on the stories that you hear and the testimony that you see before Congress, how much piracy do you think happens because, on university networks? What do you think the answer would be? Give me a number. 25%. Did you say 25? 95%. That's a better number for me. 95%. Certainly the majority. Does anybody happen to know from Casey Green's survey what the actual number is? 3%. 3%. And I would argue that piracy isn't even, so antithetical aside, right? Parenthetical aside, the we get labeled because we're easy to see and we're their demographic and we can be carved out. But if you stop to think about it, it actually makes sense. In the early days, in the real Napster days, we had the high-speed networks, and nobody else did. Today, everybody has high-speed networks, right? And so the majority of people who are connected to the internet aren't connected through us. Ergo, the majority of the piracy that happens ain't happening through us, right? But I would argue that piracy isn't even the main problem that the music industry faces. The music industry's problem is unbundling. Forever and ever, through all the technology changes, the business model for the music industry has been to take good songs and bad songs. They cost the same to produce. And good and bad here doesn't mean critically acclaimed. A good song, if you're in the recording industry, is one that makes money. And a bad song is one that doesn't. And it's hard to predict which of those are going to be which. And they cost the same to produce. So the way the recording industry has dealt with that is to bundle them, good songs and bad songs together, and release them in an album, right? And people go out and buy the albums. And that model lasted from vinyl, from wax to vinyl to cassettes to, God help us, 8 tracks. The idea that you would change tracks in the middle of a song, just, I don't know. And up to CDs, again, until the internet comes in. And the internet totally disrupts that. And I would argue that where it really gets disruptive are in services like iTunes. Because what iTunes does is it says, I'm going to unbundle the album. So my children, who are not so young anymore, but my children for most of their lives have lived in a household where for pretty obvious employment reasons, we were not going to be accused of piracy in our house. We were not going to get a DMCA notice anywhere in our house, right? So the deal that I cut with them was, you have, within reason, pretty much unlimited buying power for music, right? Because it's cheaper for me to pay 99 cents a hit than it is to go through a job search, right? So here, and it is still the case with them, one finishing college and one firmly in college right now, that about every day or two, I get an iTunes notice, another little 99 cents. Every once in a while, it creeps up a little high, and I call them, and I just go, but I don't want to push them over to the other side. So it's a delicate balance. But what I find interesting is their mother and I use iTunes, and we buy albums. If I hear an artist that I think is really interesting, I buy albums. My kids do not. My kids sample, they preview songs, and they only buy things that they like. Why? Because for them, the scarce resource is not money, because I'm a bank, right? The scarce resource for them is attention. They are not willing to allocate attention to what they consider to be crap, right? And that's the challenge. It's unbundling. Now, what does unbundling have to do with us? So think about libraries. I'm going to argue that libraries, in fact, have historically had a bundled service. A set of services, I'm only going to focus on three. So access has historically been the main business of libraries, right? It's deep in library culture. Philosophically, it's about providing access. Now we might say it's also about providing access long-term, but it's about providing access. In the analog world, access fed two other businesses, two other processes, very naturally. Preservation, because if I buy a book and own a book, I have the legal right to preserve that book, right? So it drives preservation, and it drives what I would call knowledge navigation. If you are the place where people come to for information, it makes sense that you have information navigation sources, resources there, so you have references. And technology comes along, electronic access comes along, and it unbundles that. So while it is still the case that libraries pay for access, the perception in the world, and much of, I would argue that most of the access that people experience in their daily lives to information is not moderated, mediated through the library anymore, right? Access in this world for the library, I would argue, is a declining process. Yeah, if you thought of it as a business area, it's a declining business area. And yet preservation, right, the need for preservation, even though it's been unbundled, is no less today than it was yesterday. And now it's harder because in an electronic world, I don't actually have the right to preserve things electronically that I have in a physical world when I buy a book. When you get an electronic access to something, you get a license that, among other things, does not grant you the ability to make a copy, retain that copy for the ages, right? And in fact, I would tell you that today, I think one of the biggest threats to the Academy is the fact that the scholarly record today and for is totally at risk. Everybody loves the access that online gives to people. Everybody can find me today, but my intellectual grandchildren, there's a pretty good chance that if I wrote something that was worth keeping, they will not be able to find it unless we do something about it. The other process that it unbundles is if people aren't coming to you for access, you're no longer a natural place necessarily for knowledge navigation services. And then you also have other technologies that are in disrupting that through increasingly sophisticated search algorithms. The point is not, the point here simply is it's unbundling it, right? A lot of the existential angst that's happening around libraries right now, I would argue, is the same kind of existential angst that should have been happening in the recording industry, but instead they pointed to piracy. And if you think about higher education more generally, it's true with a vengeance. Think about an undergraduate curriculum at a residential-based institution. At Virginia, I don't think you can pay for a single course. You come in and you pay a bundled tuition, and that tuition gives you classes, and it gives you libraries and lecture halls, but it also gives you theater, and it gives you football, and it gives you community, and it gives you a whole bunch of things. And when I was the undergraduate chair in psychology at Michigan, I taught the intro psych class, which had 1,200 students in it, right? And I went, and that class was the thing that allowed the university to teach small seminars with only 12 people. If you sort of did a profit loss, we made millions of dollars on intro psych. And we lost millions of dollars on the rest of the curriculum. But it didn't matter because it was all bundled, right? So we didn't have to worry about that. And what I went to the department chair and said, what I'm worried about is I'd love to believe that being in a class with 1,200 people, physically being in a class with me, really means something. But I will tell you that with a modest investment, I could design an online course that would compete with my face-to-face class of 1,200 on any dimension you want at a significantly lower cost and could be delivered at a significantly lower price. And somebody's going to do that. And if somebody from Harvard does that, how's Michigan going to respond? Because why wouldn't students start to migrate and say, I'm going to take those courses that are convenient to take online and that don't add a lot of value by being physically present, I'm going to take those online from wherever I can get them, and I'm going to take the face-to-face stuff, the stuff that we lose money on, I'm going to take that with a vengeance. If we do that, right, then the whole model breaks. It comes unbundled. Another way to think about that is if you want to try to prevent that from happening, like falling off the stage, if you want to prevent that from happening, one of the things we have to start thinking about is not necessarily how do we create, we were talking about this at lunch, not how do you create an online program to compete with online programs, it's how do you think to add more value on top of it. So for the library, for example, you know, if I were going to say, what is the thing that libraries need to be focusing on most right now in their mission, it's preservation. There is nobody else out there who is tasked or funded to do preservation. Residential-based education, we've actually got to focus on the residential part of it if we want it to be to thrive going forward. Okay, second disruptive force, commoditization. Commoditization is, again, you know, commoditization is really just new, typically inferior technology comes along on a faster development curve that drives costs down and market penetration. So a quick story. How did the United States lose steel? In the 1980s, we owned worldwide steel production, and by the 1990s, we had lost it. How did that happen? Well, it happened because we had steel plants that could produce all kinds of steel, including surgical-grade stainless steel. And the Japanese invented this technology called mini-forge. And it couldn't create stainless steel. It could just initially just do pig iron, but it could do it at a fraction of the cost. Our plants would cost $1 billion to build at that time. Their plants would cost $250 million to build. So the U.S. steel industry responded by saying, no problem. They just do cruddy steel. There's not much market for us in cruddy steel. We'll give it up. We'll let them have it. The problem is that the U.S. steel was on an established, fully developed technology. Mini mill was a new technology. Every generation gets better than the one before it. And so over the next decade, mini mill technology kept going higher and higher up the food chain at significantly lower costs until in the end, that's the way almost all steel is produced. What does that have to do with education? Think about things like the University of Phoenix. You know, people think that the University of Phoenix is about online education. It is not. They do have an online education component, and it is growing fast for them, but that's not what the University of Phoenix is about. The University of Phoenix is about commoditizing the curriculum, standardizing the curriculum, lowering the labor costs and distribution costs. So the point that the University of Phoenix does is if you take an accounting course and you take it in Phoenix or you take it in Charlottesville from the University of Phoenix, it's the same course, same textbook, same lecture materials, same learning objective, same test. The goal is to make instructors pretty much interchangeable. It's to drive the labor cost down and commoditize it, right? And here's an interesting statistic. Traditional higher education last year grew 1%. For-profit online for-profit grew 12%. So just keep playing that out for a while and ask what's going to happen to traditional education models when the modal person didn't get their education that way, right? If you think it's tough to get support for public education now, wait until most of the people who are sitting in the state legislatures got their degrees from places like Phoenix, right? If the growth curves continue. So again, huge threat. Last disruptive force, consumerization. It is a real word. I didn't make it up. And consumerization is really just to note, to identify that increasingly technology goes directly to consumers, bypassing the enterprise. And that has huge implications for technology organizations. My first example of this came from networks. Remember when Apple came out with the airport? The Apple airport had a couple of things. First, it was from Apple, so it was cute, right? It was aesthetically pleasing, right? It's interesting how aesthetically pleasing changes over time, but it was aesthetically pleasing at the time, and it was cheap. Individuals could buy it. And we had these networks where we had perfect control. We controlled all the wired ports, and wireless was too expensive for anybody to put it in. And suddenly Apple releases it. They didn't talk with us. They didn't ask our permission. They released it, and people show up, and suddenly our whole network strategy goes a question in. Or think about what's happening with email, right? Lots of people are outsourcing email. Why are they outsourcing email? Well, because it's totally consumerized, right? We give people email boxes. They can get them. I mean, they're better than the prize whistles you get in cereal boxes. It's free. It costs nothing. You don't even have to buy the box, right? Again, technology is consumerizing. At Virginia, one of the things we're wrestling with right now a lot is consumerization in public labs. We put in public labs for two purposes, to provide technology access when students didn't have it, when computers were rare, right? All UVA students have computers. 99% of them have laptops. The second reason why we put it in was to deliver very specialized software. And yet, over time, what we've done is the popularity of those labs kept growing, so we kept adding more, right? And now we're actually in the process of phasing out commodity public computing labs. Not because they're not popular. They're immensely popular. Right? This is not a popular move that we're making, but because we have to ride consumerization. I have to take the fact that they're now investing in laptops, and that frees up an investment that I can make to invest in, say, a better course management system or better support. Think about consumerization and support. Again, this is a point made sort of obliquely earlier. Part of the challenge that we have now is if you're going to roll out an ERP or you're going to roll out a course management system, one of the things that you think about is, how much training do I have to put in the budget? How am I going to get to my end users to train them? I got news for you, folks. They don't want to be trained, and they increasingly don't expect to be trained. Think about it. If you're Bank of America and you're rolling out online banking, and you want people to use it, if you have to train them, you're done. It's over. Increasingly, that's the world we're going to have to work in, and we're going to have to figure out how to provide support in that world. Consumerization and storage, this is just a little minor point. I have my documents folder backed up automatically through the cloud to an encrypted way. I'm sure it's against university policy, but I'm doing it for experimental and investigative purposes. And that's my bill. 2 cents. Think about what it would cost to roll out in your shop a backup solution for people's laptops. And, you know, it's consumerized, so it took me 5 minutes to set up. And then this one is consumerization of software. First, a really quick story, which was the day a law professor came to my office, scheduled an appointment, looked at the subject line, what's the purpose of the appointment, my assistant had put, to tell you you're an idiot. So I was really looking forward to this one. And what he was incensed by was we had just picked Sakai as the course management system going forward, and it was a faculty group, and he picked it. And he came in and he said, have you looked at Sakai? Do you know anything about Sakai? I actually wrote the first development check for Sakai. Have you looked at Sakai? Do you know what it is? I said, yeah. He goes, it's a battleship. I mean, it's got a chat tool, but it's terrible. And it's got, you know, you can create web pages, but it's terrible. And he goes, and what I want is this, right? I want social networking built into it. And I want wikis built into it. And have you seen Confluence? It's great. I love that. And WordPress. I mean, why can't it be WordPress? That's the thing that you want for a blog, right? And I said to him, well, you realize that that doesn't actually exist, right? What you're doing is going out and picking best of breed, and you're saying, I want that and this, and that's not the way course management systems are designed right now. And yet the challenge that we have to confront is, that's the world they want, and it is the world they will create. Because, in fact, to get access to all these sources, faculty and students don't need us. So how do we respond to that? Okay, very quickly. What are the implications of this for organizations and leadership? If it's constant change, and if it's disruptive change, and you can identify some of the fundamental forces, what does it mean for organizations and leadership? The first is IT organizations especially have to embrace change. And I think I came to the University of Virginia largely as a change agent, and it's been an interesting and ongoing evolving process. Because the technology organization, ironically, is part of the organization that's the most resistant to change. And I sort of point out to them, lovingly, that, you know, you went into a field that has an 18-month change cycle. What were you thinking? Right? It's inevitable, so we got to find ways to embrace change again, to ride it and leverage it. The second thing is, in a world where the focus is more on direction and constant assessment, relationships matter. I will tell you that I believe the way I get almost everything done is by the relationships that I cultivate and by the relationships the organization cultivates. And we have spent in the last 3 years at Virginia an enormous amount of time and resources helping the organization develop skills for creating and sustaining relationships internally among each other, internally with hierarchy, and externally with our collaborators across grounds. The third is the strategic importance of collaboration in this world of constant change. So I believe that this is, largely enabled by technology, this is the age of collaboration. And people say, oh, universities can't really collaborate, except at a very high abstract level, because we compete with each other. So how do you reconcile the fact that we compete with each other with the fact that you say, above campus sourcing, the cloud, how we aggregate our demand across institutions is going to be critical if we're going to hit the financial challenges that lie ahead of us. How do you reconcile that with the fact that we compete? And my flip answer now is, because what you've got to recognize is that strategic advantage comes from picking the right collaborations. It's picking who's going to be like-minded, who's going to go with you, who's going to be aligned with your purposes. So collaboration is different from cooperation. Cooperation is as simple as, I don't hurt you, you don't hurt me, right? We're fine. That's cooperation. Collaboration actually requires us to find a common purpose, to work together for that common purpose. And collaborations last as long as the common purpose lasts, and they evaporate when the purpose goes away, and that's okay. It's not a judgment thing. It's the way you get work done. The fifth is leadership. And by leadership, I do not mean leadership at the top. Leadership at the top is important, but it's not where most of the work gets done, and it's not where most of the leadership has to happen. So also in the organizational work that we do against this backdrop of constant and continuous change and the need for collaboration is work that we talk about in terms of professional development and collaboration and powerful speaking and a whole bunch of things, none of which sound like leadership. But I will tell you that what they really are is they're tools designed to make every individual empowered to lead. Because if everything has to get approved through the hierarchy, and lead with accountability, lead with integrity, right? If everything has to get approved through the hierarchy, it will not happen. And you know that because if you've ever been in a union state and the union wants to stop things, what they start doing is work to the contract. Work towards the formal approval and everything stops. So we focus a lot on leadership. The last thing that we focus on is the importance of power as opposed to force. So I have the authority to make people, and the technology to make people do a lot of things. You know, we make people log into our network. Any compliance issue you want, I could tie to that login. They want to get to our network bad enough that I could just start forcing everything through, forcing it. And if I do that, I will be wholly unsuccessful. And they'll hate me, right? So instead, what I spend a lot of time doing is, again, cultivating relationships, collaboration, and enrolling people in a vision. What MLK did was enrolled people in a vision. Didn't threaten them. Didn't force them. Enrolled them in a powerful and compelling vision. And that's part of the challenge that we have as technologists, is to enroll folks in a powerful vision. And the last, and I think most importantly, is remain brave of heart. Right? We live in a time right now where you get titles like, does IT matter? Probably no title has, the polite word to say is irritated me more than that title. Because to me, it's sort of like asking, does oxygen matter? Well, it doesn't give you strategic advantage, but it's really hard to function without it, right? What we do matters from an essential standpoint. It also matters strategically. If, in fact, you pick up where I started, the fabric of inquiry is changing, and that change is being driven by technology, then what we do is of vital importance. And the challenge that we have is to how to enroll people in a partnership around that importance. Not how to force them to do technology, but how to enroll them in a shared possibility. And last, urgency. Not someday, now. This transformation is going to happen over the next 10 years. And we live at the center. So I'll actually pick up with where you were at the introduction. It is, despite declining budgets, despite a lot of questions about, you know, do we spend too much on IT, despite all those challenges, this is a great time to be in the academy in IT because everything is up for grabs. I'll stop there.
A speech by James Hilton, Vice President and CIO for the University of Virginia. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. Thanks for listening.